Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue our analysis of some events involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4th of 1968. We have been relying for our information in this series, and we'll continue to do so, on a book, a recent book, and a marvelous book entitled Orders to Kill, subtitled The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King. That's authored by William F. Pepper, currently James Earl Ray's attorney. And it's published in hardcover by Carroll and Graff, copyright 1995. James Earl Ray, by the way, the patsy for the assassination of Martin Luther King. This book is not only, in my opinion, the best book on the assassination of Martin Luther King, it also is one of the very best books on America's political assassinations and illustrates, I think, very clearly the complex mosaic in which elements such as organized crime, the intelligence community, and the regular military are woven together in such a way as to provide not only the event itself, but also the official cover story. We begin by taking a look at what I have termed the, quote, civilian, unquote, conspiracy, namely an organized crime intelligence community conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King, which actually produced the fatal headshot which took Dr. King's life. That appears to have been fired by an organized crime operative named Raoul, who was James Earl Ray's handler and helped to maneuver James Earl Ray in the position of from which he could be made into the patsy, the alleged assassin of Martin Luther King. Raoul appears to have had connections with both the intelligence community and organized crime, and specifically was involved in some gun-running activities, which were involved with Carlos Marcello's New Orleans mafia operations. Carlos Marcello, the mafia godfather for much of the South and Southwest, an individual whose name has cropped up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy as well. Carlos Marcello apparently generated the contract from New Orleans that was to become the, quote, civilian, unquote, wing of the assassination conspiracy, and he utilized a fellow named Frank C. Liberto, a Memphis produce dealer and organized crime associate of Carlos Marcello's. Liberto, in turn, recruited a Memphis restaurant owner named Lloyd Jowers, who owed him a tremendous amount of money from gambling. Jowers ran a restaurant called Jim's Grill, which was adjacent to the rooming house from which James Earl Ray supposedly fired the shot. Jowers' role was to handle the weapon that Raoul was to use to kill Martin Luther King before the assassination and to retrieve it from Raoul afterward. He performed both functions. Liberto, by the way, died in 1978 as the House Select Committee investigation was proceeding forward, albeit very haltingly, and after his name had surfaced in connection with the assassination. We also took a look at the death of William Sartor, a Time magazine journalist who was investigating the organized crime connection to Martin Luther King's assassination. We then began an examination of an army intelligence operation which was not only spying on various black American leaders in the 1960s, this a carryover of an operation actually begun during World War I, but specifically we took a look at some special forces teams operating on behalf of military intelligence which were used to eliminate troublesome leaders, in particular black leaders, in the 1960s. We took a look at the fears that were held by many leaders in the military and intelligence community, as well as the political establishment, that in fact the progressive politics of the 1960s may very well have resulted in a civil war or an armed revolution or an overthrow of the government. For this reason, deadly force and covert operation were used against various elements of the progressive political sector. In particular, we've been taking a look at an Alpha Team 184, an eight-man special forces team recruited from the 20th Special Forces Group, a reserve special forces unit based in Birmingham, Alabama, that in turn was deployed under the auspices, that is to say Alpha Team 184, deployed under the auspices of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. This team had several sniper teams. This eight-man special forces team had several sniper teams in place to assassinate not only Martin Luther King, but also his aide, Andrew Young, later U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, in the event that the civilian sniper missed his target. The civilian sniper did not, and the special forces teams were then disengaged on order. As we have seen in our last segment, the author was able to secure from one member of those special forces teams, whom he terms Warren. By the way, living members of the team are referred to by pseudonyms. Dead members are referred to by name and in many instances also by their actual service numbers. This is a hard documented connection, and the author, as well as the special forces team members who have come forward at this even at this great distance in time, I think deserve a lot of credit for exhibiting a tremendous personal courage in bringing us the truth concerning a very, very important historical event. We also took a look at the actual orders, I should say, that were given to William F. Pepper by, quote, Warren, unquote, again a pseudonym. These were the orders for the deployment of Alpha Team 184 in Memphis, Tennessee on a 4-4-68. These orders were marked, interestingly enough, Oplan Garden Plot. That was the code name for combined civilian police, civilian intelligence agency, and military intelligence coordination against progressive political movements in the 1960s. Most analysts have that program actually having been begun under Richard Nixon's administration. It would appear from the photographic reproduction of these orders that the Nixon administration's efforts in that regard were simply a carryover from plans that were already on the books. And indeed, Garden Plot was the code name for the orders issued to various military units in connection with the Los Angeles riots of the spring of 1992. So they have not gone away. We took a look at the many powerful people and powerful agencies that appear to have been aware of the deployment to Memphis, including the White House, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, and many people in the intelligence community and military. A Pentagon intelligence source of William Pepper's confirmed the authenticity of these orders. We're going to resume with our examination of the military end of the Martin Luther King assassination conspiracy, and what we're going to look at next is an assertion by Warren that he had heard from another member of the team that 20th Special Forces Group members had been deployed to assassinate Martin Luther King in 1965 when Dr. King led his famous civil rights march in Selma, Alabama. As I speak, in September of 1995, we have recently observed the anniversary of that particular event with former Alabama Governor George Wallace, himself having been crippled by an assassin's bullet or would-be assassin's bullet, now participating in the commemoration of that event, whereas he opposed it in 1965. According to the information that was presented by Warren, which he in turn learned from a member of the sniper team of Alpha Team 184, who had been previously a member of the 20th Special Forces Group team that had been deployed in Selma, Alabama to kill Martin Luther King in 1965. According to the information presented here, Martin Luther King took a sudden, unexpected turn, and that is why he was not assassinated at the Selma Civil Rights March, but later in Memphis, Tennessee in April of 1968. Returning once again to the book Orders to Kill by William F. Pepper, hardcover, Carolyn Graff. Of the previous attempt by elements recruited from the 20th Special Forces Group to kill Dr. King in 1965 at the Selma March, the author writes as follows. Bear in mind again that Warren, Murphy, Herbert, Gardner, and Carson are all pseudonyms here, as is Reynolds and as are Reynolds and Norton. These are living members of the team. Dead members are referred by the two by their actual names and in many cases service numbers as well. Obviously, this is a sensitive connection, and the author was warned many times that researching this could be very dangerous. Continuing with Orders to Kill. Warren said he had heard about one other time when a 20th Special Forces Group unit had almost, quote, taken out, unquote, Dr. King. This was during the Selma March in 1965. Warren said the sniper, who was also a member of the Memphis Alpha 184 team, claimed that on that occasion he actually had the SCLC leader, quote, center mass, unquote, the center of his chest and the crosshairs of his scope, in his sights awaiting the order to fire, which never came because Dr. King turned sharply away at the opportune moment and was closely surrounded thereafter on the march. Warren would not name this soldier or any other member of the team except his expatriate buddy Murphy, who consented and also provided information. Though he was unaware of it, the names of all eight, including his own, had been independently provided by Herbert, the officer in the ACSI office, ACSI, by the way, Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence, who corroborated their active duty presence in Memphis on April 4th as members of the Alpha 184 team, which had been selected and coordinated by Gardner of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. Herbert's further check of the files revealed that the 20th Special Forces Group did indeed have a sniper team deployed to the Selma area for the beginning of the march from Selma to Montgomery. Two of the members of that Selma team confirmed that King was being targeted until he turned left at one point and crossed a bridge. The next segment of Orders to Kill deals with an individual who was apparently a member of the 20th Special Forces Group sniper team that was to kill Martin Luther King in Selma, and was also a member of the Alpha 184 team in Memphis that was the backup team to the civilian snipers. This individual, now deceased, is John D. Hill, a Buck sergeant, and information about Hill was provided to William Pepper by a fellow who he terms Carson, again a pseudonym to protect this individual's life. Returning to Orders to Kill, there was one soldier on both that Selma 20th Special Forces Group team and the April 4th Alpha 184 team in Memphis. His name was John D. Hill, or J.D., a Buck sergeant who was murdered in 1979. As mentioned earlier, on October 16, 1994, I made contact with a man whom I will call Carson and who knew J.D. well. More importantly, J.D. had shared with him what he personally knew about the King assassination plan. When I raised the subject of J.D.'s involvement in the killing of Dr. King and asked him whether J.D. had ever discussed the operation with him, he sighed and was silent for a while. He said the subject had come up, but he was reluctant to open up this can of worms since it could lead to the two of us being killed. He uttered the familiar phrase, quote, "You don't know who you're dealing with," unquote. I told him that by now I was getting the idea. The problem was that my client was innocent of this crime and had served nearly 26 years in prison, and that even though his innocence was becoming ever more obvious, the state had spurned every face-saving opportunity to free him, which I had put forward. Consequently, I had little choice, and certain risks were necessary. I believed that the only way to free him would be to solve the case conclusively, and that we had progressed very far toward this goal. Carson gradually came around. He said that in the mid-1970s, J.D. appeared to want to shed some baggage about his past. He told Carson about an assassination mission he had trained for over a period of many months to be carried out on a moment's notice. He was in training with a small unit selected from the mission because they were all members of the 20th Special Forces Group. He said that J.D. was a member of the 20th Special Forces Group, which Carson came to learn, although officially a Special Forces Reserve unit, actually was used for a wide range of covert special or, quote, behind-the-fence, unquote, operations inside and outside of the U.S. J.D. told him that on April 4th, the main body of the Alpha 184 team arrived in cars from Camp Shelby, which was their staging base and the training home for the 20th Special Forces Group reservists. Each year, the 20th Special Forces Group traveled to Camp Shelby for 2 weeks of field training with other units. That, by the way, was in Mississippi. Shelby was used because of the size of the facility, which allowed for the live firing of long-range weapons within the compound. With respect to the Memphis mission, he said that all weapons, material, and immediate orders were generated from the base, although the actual preparation for a triangulation shooting had been previously practiced at a site near Pocatello, Idaho. At an early stage, the scenario called for a triangular shot on a moving vehicle in an urban setting. At the time, no official details were provided about the mission, and the man believed that it was to be directed at an Arab target. J.D. said that though he soon learned that the mission was to be executed in Memphis, Tennessee, the target still remained a mystery. He believed that some of the team had gone to the city earlier. Carson had the impression that the team consisted of seven, not eight persons, and that there were three shooters, a communications specialist, logistical and transportation officers, and a unit commander. Since each of the soldiers was trained in at least three MOSs, or military skills, some members would have doubled up as spotters, as this function was always required. He said that J.D. identified the sites as a rooftop, a water tower, and a third-story window, with the team expecting to have to fire upon and hit their targets. There was more than one when they were in a moving car entering or leaving the motel parking lot. The team knew that the King party was going to dinner that evening, and they didn't believe for a minute that Dr. King would appear on the balcony in such an exposed position. They were convinced that it was a kill for which they were going to have to work. The weapons that Carson said J.D. told him were carried by the team were in line with the list provided by Warren, down to and including the light anti-tank weapons, or LAWs. Carson said it was obvious from the way J.D. spoke that something went wrong and that they had to leave unexpectedly and quickly. They, or some members of the team, were flown out from West Memphis. Carson agreed to fax the information to me and to include the name and address of J.D.'s unit partner, who he said was very different from J.D. Conditioned by his experiences in Vietnam, he was apparently a stone killer, a, quote, psycho, unquote, said Carson. Carson said he had always had reservations about J.D.'s death. He said the official account made no sense to him. J.D. was allegedly shot to death at point-blank range by his wife sometime after midnight on January 12, 1979. She apparently fired 5 bullets from his .357 Magnum into a closely confined area of his chest. He was dead before he hit the floor. Carson said it had all the signs of a professional killing. He had known J.D.'s wife and did not believe that she had the strength or the capability to handle a large firearm with the precision described. He recalled that she left or was taken out of town shortly afterward, and that she was never indicted for the crime. Carson believed that J.D., a heavy drinker, might have begun to talk to others about the Memphis operation, and that this could have been the reason he was killed. I remember that Warren had said that he had left the country because he believed a cleanup process had begun within a year of the assassination, and that if he returned to the United States, he would be, quote, immediately killed, unquote. Though he wouldn't name the team member who he said was shot in the back of the head in New Orleans, I noted that Eidson and Worley were also both dead. My investigator, Buck Buchanan, spoke with the first officer on the scene after the shooting of J.D., Donald Freshour, F-R-E-S-H-A-U-R, who arrived only minutes after. He said that Janice Hill told him that she, quote, couldn't take it anymore, unquote. Her husband, J.D., had a history of heavy drinking and abusive behavior. I obtained a copy of the court records relating to the death and confirmed that there was no indictment. She was released and lives today in another town in Mississippi. As mentioned earlier, just before we ended, Carson said, quote, this meeting never took place. You have to be very careful, unquote, he said. Again, quoting, they'll drop you where you stand, unquote. Before we continue with the account of J.D., J.D. Hill, or John D. Hill and Carson, please note the strange circumstances surrounding J.D.'s death. He was shot to death at point-blank range, 5 bullets from a .357 Magnum into a closely confined area of his chest. His wife was officially fingered as his killer. He was apparently had drinking and abuse problems. However, she was never indicted. That is extremely unusual and raises serious questions about the circumstances surrounding his death. Again, Carson, familiar with her, did not believe that she was capable of handling that powerful a weapon with that degree of precision. Continuing. When Carson's fax note came through on plain paper a couple of weeks later, it confirmed what he told me and provided further information. J.D.'s team was positioned on a Tayloe, T-A-Y-L-O-E, paper company water tower. J.D. thought that the other two teams were on a rooftop and a third-story window. I knew that there was a cluster of water towers on top of the various Tayloe Paper Company buildings which stretched westward back toward Front Street and the river. Carson wrote that J.D. confirmed that something had gone wrong and the mission was aborted. They disengaged, were picked up, and driven out of South Memphis to West Memphis, Arkansas Airport, where they were placed on a small aircraft and flown to Amory, Mississippi, after releasing their weapons and other gear to the logistics officer who remained behind. They apparently dispersed at that point, J.D. returning to his home in Columbus. J.D. told Carson that everything that had transpired during the training phase up to and including the mission was classified as top secret. J.D. learned upon his arrival in Columbus that Dr. King had been assassinated. I had no information about the inclusion on the Alpha 184 team of a third shooter, and Warren had always firmly believed that there were only two shooters. Two of the locations described to Carson by J.D. were credible, since we know that Warren and Murphy were on the roof of the Central Illinois Railroad building, and the main Tayloe Paper Company water tower also met the criteria for a perch. It was remarkable that J.D.'s account, coming to me 20 years after Carson had heard it, independently confirmed the presence of a Camp Shelby-based 20th Special Forces Group Alpha 184 shooting team in Memphis on April 4, 1968, which had drawn from crack reserves of the 20th with Martin King as a target. Further, J.D. had said that a team had been training for that mission for a period of several months. This time frame is in line with the date, October 23, 1967, when Gardner of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group got the 20th Special Forces Group roster and began to handpick the team. When subsequently asked, Warren confirmed that Pocatello, Idaho, was a training area. Warren and Murphy never knew that I had access to J.D.'s story. Neither did they or Carson know the names of each member. Know that the names of each member of the Alpha 184 team had been provided to me by Herbert. One of the names on that list also matched the name of the person independently named by Carson as J.D.'s unit partner. So again, the documentation for this is quite substantive. The last item that we're going to deal with in this segment concerns other members of the Alpha 184 Special Forces Group, Alpha 184 team from the 20th Special Forces Group. This individual is called Reynolds and is given the pseudonym Reynolds, and along with his partner Norton, they were there to conduct photographic reconnaissance of Martin Luther King and actually had the opportunity to photograph the falling Dr. King and his assassin. Returning once again to Orders to Kill. Warren, who I had come to believe was credible and reliable, also said that a photograph of the actual shooting from the brush area existed, and that sometime after the event he had seen it. He said the shooter was not James Earl Ray. I recall that Doug Valentine had reported in his book, The Phoenix Program, that there was a rumor that such a photograph had been taken. Warren provided the name and address of the now-retired officer who supposedly had a copy and agreed to approach him. The former PsyOps officer, whom I will call, quote, Reynolds, unquote, agreed to have contact, but initially he insisted on the same procedure that had been used with his Latin American buddies. My questions would be carried to him by a former intelligence officer whom we both trusted. The meeting was set for early December of 1994 in the coffee shop of the Hyatt Regency Hotel near Michigan Avenue in Chicago. Reynolds was about 5 feet 10 inches tall, 160 to 170 pounds, with gray, short-cropped hair. He said that in Vietnam he had been assigned to the 1st Special Operations Group, based in Can Tho, and that he worked with the 525th Psychological Operations Battalion. Reynolds said that he and his partner, whom I will call Norton, were deployed to Memphis on April 3rd as part of a wider mission they believed was under the overall command of Gardner of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, whom Reynolds knew and for whom he had worked on a number of assignments. They carried the necessary camera equipment and were armed with standard-issue .45 caliber automatics. Norton also carried a small revolver in a holster in the small of his back. They arrived before noon on that day and went directly to Fire Station 2, where the captain, Cartel Weeden, W-E-E-D-E-N, whose name had never surfaced in any official report or file that I have seen, facilitated their access to the flat roof. They took up their positions on the east side of the roof. From that vantage point, they overlooked the Lorraine and were well placed to carry out their mission, which was to visually and photographically surveil the King group at the Lorraine Motel and pick out any individuals in photos who might be identified as a communist or national security threat. In the spring of 1995, I went up onto the roof, and I was impressed with the completely unobstructed view of the balcony in front of Dr. King's room 306. From 1 p.m., they began forwarding reports to the local IEOC office from which they were sent on to the headquarters of the 111th Military Intelligence Group in Fort McPherson, and then to Gardner of the 902nd MIG. Sources inside the 111th Military Intelligence Group confirmed that regular reports were received on April 3rd and 4th. This surveillance continued throughout the afternoon and resumed again the next morning, April 4th. It was in play throughout the day, and the same process of transmitting information was followed. Because of Jim Kellum's information and Eli Arkin's admission to me that agents of the 111th had been inside the offices of the Memphis Police Department Intelligence Bureau, I have come to believe it likely that in the first instance the reports were called into them at MPD headquarters from the fire station and then transmitted onward. This process would conform to the chain of communications for such activity described in the 1973 Senate Judiciary Subcommittee Report on Constitutional Rights. There would have been no reason for Captain Weeden to have been told or know about the assassination plot, and I have no reason to believe that he did know. When I visited Weeden in June of 1995, He indicated his awareness of the photographers on the roof, except that when the discussion turned to how they got up there, he talked in terms of how it, quote, could, unquote, or, quote, would, unquote, have happened. He said that they would not have gone up on the roof using the inside vertical ladder in the garage, but would have been given a, quote, short, unquote, ladder in order to climb up from the side of the building. From what Reynolds said, at the very moment that we now know the 20th Special Forces Group Alpha 184 snipers had Dr. King and Andrew Young center mass in the crosshairs of their M16 scopes, his camera was trained on Dr. King as he stood on the balcony while Norton was watching and shooting any arriving cars. At 6:01 p.m., the fatal moment when the shot rang out, Reynolds said he was surprised and in rapid succession quickly snapped four or five photos following Dr. King as he fell to the balcony floor. Reynolds said Norton almost instinctively swung his camera from its parking lot focus to the left and, focusing on the brush area, caught the assassin, a white man, on film as he was lowering his rifle. He then took several shots of him as he was leaving the scene. Reynolds said that though Norton had caught the assassin clearly in his camera, he personally only saw the back of the shooter as he left the scene. He said that they hand-delivered the pictures to Gardner, but Norton kept the negatives and made another set of prints which Reynolds said he had seen. I recall that Warren had also said that he had viewed them. Reynolds categorically stated, as had Warren earlier, that the sniper in the photograph was not James Earl Ray. We will be continuing in our next segment with an analysis of the military end, so to speak, of the Martin Luther King assassination conspiracy. We will be examining connections of a fellow named Jack Youngblood to this milieu, a name that's cropped up in connection with the assassination for a number of years in this author's opinion. That is to say, William Pepper, was not directly involved in the assassination, but knew many of the people who were. And we're also going to be taking a look at the alias Eric Galt that James Earl Ray used while on the lam. Those who would like to obtain some background on the assassination of Martin Luther King and related topics can access a tape duplication service called Archives on Audio, which has an extensive series of documentaries that I've put together over the years on permanent file. These documentaries are called archive shows, and they consist of printed sources read on the air, literally extracted on the air, so that listeners can tape the programs and use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. They are similar in form to these half-hour segments. Archives on Audio is in San Francisco at P.O. Box 17002. P.O. Box 170023 in San Francisco. The zip code is 94117-0023. The phone number is 415-346-1840. That's 415-346-1840. There is a list of all of the archive shows available as a 20-page catalog, which gives descriptions of each of the archive shows and cross-references them with other broadcasts containing similar or related material. Listeners who have access to the World Wide Web can dial up the World Wide Web page for KFJC-FM, the home base station in Northern California where I record these programs, and access all of the archive show descriptions and cross-references as well as a suggested reading list and other sources to pursue in order to gain more information on this subject. The KFJC World Wide Web page can be obtained by dialing up all, by the way, smaller lowercase letters, http://www.cygnus.com/misc/kfjc.html. Once again, that's http://www.cygnus.com/misc/kfjc.html. That again for the KFJC webpage. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.